Okay, and on the dot of 1 o'clock, we begin. Two more lectures left before Christmas. This one, we're going to be looking at the idea of what is the nature of business in a remix culture. And then we've got one on remixing power, and we've got one more critique session with your e-publications. But today's is probably the most macro of all the sessions that we'll be running. As usual, I'll be talking for the first half hour, Joe will be talking for the second half hour, coming at the same question from two different directions. Okay, so remixing business. These are your brands, these are your clients, these are your businesses that you are working for in your e-publication. All of them are businesses, obviously. All of them are organisations. Even those that are non-profit organisations are still a business in the sense they still have to make money in order to be able to rehouse dogs or do any of the other supporting families with hyperactive children, etc., etc. So they are businesses. Whether they are giant businesses like Air France or Procter & Gamble or small non-profit organisations, they are still businesses. Our usual way of thinking about what a business does is based around this. Based around the idea of I'm selling to them. In order to sell to them, in order to sell a ticket on an air flight or an innocent drink or sell the idea of getting a new dog or whatever, you need an advertiser, the old saying goes. I need an advertiser who's going to create an advert. They're going to create an advert that's going to enable me to sell this product, this service. Once I have my idea for my advert from my creative advertising and marketing people, I need a designer who is going to sit there with their marker pens, or nowadays with their copy of InDesign and Illustrator, and they will create an advert for me. And that advert will be great, because that advert will be given to my customers who will be very grateful to me. And my customer will love me, and my customer will thank me, and my customer will tug their forelock and say, you are so wise and strong giving us this message, giving us this new product, giving us this new service. Oh, let us buy this product. It was all so nice and easy then. This is a quote from the Clue Train Manifesto. If you read nothing else this year, please go on to the cluetrain.org website and read at least part of the Clue Train Manifesto. I've probably mentioned it before and I'll probably mention it again. The Clue Train Manifesto was written at the back end of the 1990s by a bunch of Americans. But aside from that, it's really good. It was essentially a clarion caller, a challenge to traditional ideas of marketing, to traditional ideas of business, and by default, traditional ideas of design. This is one of the quotes from that book. Markets are conversations. Their members communicate in language that is natural, open, honest, direct, funny, and often shocking. Whether explaining or complaining, joking or serious, the human voice is unmistakably genuine. It can't be faked. Most corporations, on the other hand, only know how to talk in the soothing, humorless monotone of the mission statement, marketing brochure, and your call is important to us, busy signal. Same old tone, same old lies. No wonder networked markets have no respect for companies unable or unwilling to speak as they do. But learning to speak in a human voice is not some trick, nor will corporations convince us they are human with lip service about, quote, listening to customers, unquote. They will only sound human when they empower real human beings to speak on their behalf. That quote underlies more or less all of the critiques that we were giving you about your presentations the other day. That the books that you were thinking of, the strategies you were thinking of, were in the soothing, humorless monotone of the mission statement, marketing brochure, and your call is important to us, busy signal. Your challenge as designers and advertisers and strategists is to figure out how to get that human voice and how to use the human crowdsourcing potential. And that's what I want to talk about for the next 25 minutes or so. The first model I want to look at, and I know Joy's going to pick up on this in her bit where she's going to provide a critique of it, is the idea of wikis. You know wikis from Wikipedia, the idea of websites where anybody can contribute content. You don't have to be a professor, you don't have to be particularly knowledgeable about something to contribute to Wikipedia. A couple of guys wrote a couple of books, Wikinomics and Macro Wikinomics. These guys tried to take the idea of what a wiki is and transfer it into the world of business, into the world of business strategy, and by extension, the world of marketing and the world of design. This is a video that they put up, and Doesn't seem to be that.
On cool winter evenings over the moors of England, thousands of starlings come together to create something extraordinary. Throughout the day, they're spread over a 20-mile radius, foraging for food and...
No, I... Oh, there we go.
Doing their starling thing. But at night, before they settle down to rest, the starlings put on one of the most spectacular shows in the natural world. It's called a murmuration, in reference to the beating of thousands of pairs of wings as the birds swirl together.
Okay.
This dap.
Obviously, the bandwidth we've got in this lecture theatre is no longer sufficient to have a murmuration operating in it. So I'll put that link on YouTube. You can watch it at your own pace. The essential point that they were taking was this metaphor of this massive cloud of birds, the murmuration of starlings. And what they talk about is how that idea of these starlings self-organising. No one starling is in charge of this. No one starling wearing a leather jacket and carrying a flick knife who says, "Follow me, I am the chief starling." No, the whole thing is organised by the crowd. They take that idea and apply it to business. Let me take a couple of their examples. The first example, which is important in some ways to at least one of the groups, Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble, a massive multinational FMCG company. That's just some of the products that they make. Procter & Gamble has not got to be a massive multinational by being some sort of groovy, hippie organisation that wants everybody to be involved and wants to be nice to the world. No, Procter & Gamble is a horrible capitalist company that's interested in making profit and making new products that they can sell. However, Procter & Gamble have embraced some of this idea of wiki business. They have a project called Connect and Develop. They used to have 7,500 scientists working across the company. Obviously, they were all men, obviously, because only men can be scientists, wearing their white coats in their laboratory, using their test tubes and things to come up with new cleaning products. This was their research and development arm, coming up with new products that they could sell. Procter & Gamble's Connect and Develop program opened up that research and development program. They used what's called an Idea Gora, which is a website where they can put an idea. They can say, we're interested in new products around this. And scientists and science students and housewives and house husbands and what have you could contribute their ideas about this product. Here's a possible formula that will work. Here's something that we developed that might work in terms of that. It would be great if the product could do this. As one of the chief executive of Procter & Gamble said, quote, someone outside your organization knows how to answer your specific question. They use this website, this incentive website, and over 90,000, quote, scientists began to work with Procter & Gamble. That's 90,000 scientists in 175 countries. From 35 Fortune 500 companies use this sort of website. So these 90,000 scientists began to work with Procter & Gamble's own scientists on developing new products. This has become so important that Procter & Gamble now develop over 50% of their new products come from ideas from outside the company. Remember, Procter & Gamble is not doing this because they're hippies and Guardian readers and tree huggers. No, they're doing it because having 90,000 people working on your new products is better than having 7,500. Are they worried about their licensing and their copyright and their patents? Yes, of course they are. But what they've managed to do is set up what they call IP licensing. So explain more in the book, you can read it for yourself. But essentially, what they do is they come to an agreement with these external scientists about the ownership and control of the intellectual property. A second example they use is this example. This is an example of crowdsourcing a mustache. No, it's not. It's crowdsourcing in terms of mining. This guy is Rob McEwen. He's the chief executive of Goldcorp, which is a Toronto-based mining company. This is a gold mining company that finds places that might have gold, digs in the ground, destroys the environment, and gets the gold out. Everything absolutely fine. Mining companies are notoriously protective and controlling of their data, their intellectual property. This company was grinding to a halt. They were losing money because they were not finding new sources of gold. So Rob McEwen decided he would put all of the data they had, going back to 1948, all of the geological data, all of the scientific data they had, he put it on a website, and similar to Procter & Gamble, he said, if there is anybody out there who could help us find this gold, help us, and we will come to an arrangement about the profits that accrue from that. In terms of this, they set up a prize and what have you, but the important thing was that geologists and students and consultants and mathematicians, military people, etc., applied all sorts of techniques to this data that was put out online. They identified 110 new possible places where Goldcorp could mine for gold. 50% of these things that they found were new, and 80% of them yielded new gold. 8 million ounces of new gold was found by crowdsourcing and opening up the data that they were given. They reckon that this saved over 2 to 3 years worth of work that the company would have had to do itself to try and find this information. A third example, IBM. Notice that each of the examples that Wikinomics uses and that I'm using now are examples of capitalist companies. It's really easy to look for crowdsourcing ideas that are coming out of left field, if you like. There's Threadless that does this with T-shirt design. We've already looked at a few different ones. But these are massive, traditional, multinational companies. IBM, Big Blue, as it was called. You probably know it from its incarnation in the film 2001 as HAL. IBM, massive company that was making all of its money from producing hardware, computer hardware. But in the age of Microsoft, they were finding they were losing money. They were losing market share to Microsoft. IBM didn't know what to do. Most of its money came from its server hardware. Okay, so not the laptops and the desktop machines, but the back-end servers. They were developing the software and the hardware and what have you. In 1998, their server share was falling. So they decided, like Procter & Gamble and like Goldcorp, to go open source, to look for ideas and for help outside the company. What they did was they started to use Linux, or Linux. Linux, as you know, is an open source operating system. So they started to use Linux as their operating system on their servers, rather than develop their own proprietary system. The advantage of Linux, or Linux, was that with developers all the way around the world who were helping to develop this software and make it better, make it more secure, make it more flexible, etc. In 1999, they formed a Linux development group. And they said to their engineers, IBM said to its own engineers, go out into these groups, go out onto the internet, into these development groups, and work with these hackers. Work with these Linux developers. Help them. Give them some of IBM's code. Give them our expertise and help them develop Linux. And then Linux will help us to develop better server software. In the end, they spent over $100 million every year on helping the Linux community develop Linux. Why would they do that? Why would IBM be spending money in the Linux community? The reason was, the more they spent out there, the more benefit they got back, because the hundreds of thousands of Linux programmers and developers were helping to make Linux better, which in the end made IBM better. IBM then took this to the next stage. And they started to realize that their business model was not actually about selling hardware, nor indeed was it actually about selling software. They gave Linux away, because Linux is free. IBM didn't start trying to charge for Linux, they gave it away. What they ended up making their money out of, and what they're continuing to make their money out of, and a lot of money, is consultancy and services. So IBM now go to a big company and says, we will give you the software, we will give you this Linux, we will give you this server software, but you will pay for the expertise in using it and integrating it with your systems. IBM's business model went from selling stuff to serving stuff, and that's where they're building their money now. So again, this was by using an open model, by putting data out there, by putting their intellectual property out there, by encouraging their customers to get involved, and enabling and empowering them to do so. Just to prove that not everything is rosy in the world of wikis and wikified business, there's the example of Harry Potter. The Harry Potter, Joy mentioned it before, Harry Potter has always been a brand that has encouraged people to contribute. So there's a large fan fiction community built around Harry Potter. And early in the series of Harry Potter books, a young woman in the States, I think her name was Heather Lawyer, ironically enough, she started a website. She was so impressed with Harry Potter, she started a website called The Daily Prophet. And this became a fan fiction site. And she ended up having kids all around the world contributing new stories about Harry Potter, new backstories about Hermione and the dentists and all that sort of stuff. And everything was going fine. And then, shortly after that, J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter books, sold the rights to the Harry Potter books to Warner Brothers, which then obviously became the films. Warner Brothers, in a very non-wiki-type fashion, started to behave like a traditional IP-owning, patent-holding-onto, copyright-demanding, non-remixing sort of business. Essentially, they sent out cease and desist letters to websites across the world, websites run by kids like Heather, and there was another kid in the UK who had a fan fiction site, and they would get letters from the lawyers saying, you must take these sites down because they are not the official Harry Potter site. Heather, in the States, didn't take this line down. In fact, she started another website called Defense Against the Dark Arts. And she took on Warner Brothers and said, this is ridiculous. Firstly, why are you trying to do this when we're actually out there marketing and selling your books for you, and by default, your films? And secondly, why are you picking on kids? These were 15, 14, 16-year-old kids across the world who were getting these letters. Warner Brothers started to get a bit panicky about this, particularly when some of the more middle-class kids started to get their parents to send lawyers' letters back to Warner Brothers, but that's another story. Heather ended up on primetime American television debating with the chief executive of Warner Brothers about whether he should not just allow her and her friends to have their fan fiction sites, but whether he should be encouraging them to have their sites. And the argument was, look what the music industry did. The music industry tried to lock down music sharing. It bought out Napster and closed it down. It's prosecuting people who share music. So rather than enabling and empowering music fans to become the ambassadors of music and bands, etc., it tries to close them down. And the argument was, why are you trying to do this with Harry Potter? Warner Brothers backed down to a certain extent. What they did was they said that they had been, quote, naive, unquote, and that there'd been a miscommunication. And then in a lovely phrase, the chief executive said, gave an example of a website that they were now working with, where they were allowing, quote, the owner to have access to material from Warner Brothers and from the films and from the books, etc. Okay. Heather quite rightly pointed out that is not the point. By that patronising attitude of allowing us to do this, you've still got the idea that Harry Potter is owned by Warner Brothers, okay, or owned by J.K. Rowling, for that matter. And the argument was, no, Harry Potter as a cultural practice, as a whole set of cultural practices indeed, is owned by the people who are making it their own, who are making up their own stories, making up their own websites, etc. So here, unlike Procter & Gamble and IBM and Goldcorp, etc., was a company who locked out its best customers, locked out its best brains, locked out those people who could be marketing it, could be designing posters for it, could be writing new chapters for it. To such an extent that Warner Brothers and J.K. Rowling have now set up a website called Pottermore, which you may have seen. And Pottermore, rather than trying to make use of fan fiction, rather than trying to make use of the creativity of these people who are still passionate about Harry Potter, is now again trying to own and control them. Okay, so that's the idea of wiki business. The idea that two ways to build an encyclopedia, one the Encyclopedia Britannica way, lock a bunch of dons in a room and hope that they come out with something profound. Secondly, create a platform that enables people to create their own open source encyclopedia, which is now the fifth most visited site on the internet. When businesses take that on board, as has been shown with Procter & Gamble and IBM and Goldcorp, it opens up new possibilities, the more people who are involved and the more people who are connected. The second model is based is basically called Gonzo Business. And this comes from one of the editors, one of the writers of the Clue Train Manifesto, Christopher Locke. I don't know if this book is in the library. I'll try and get a hold of a copy because it's now out of print. But it's called Gonzo Marketing, which for anybody who's doing anything to do with marketing, I think is the best book that I've read and doesn't read like a business book. But he takes his idea of Gonzo Marketing from Gonzo Journalism. And Gonzo Journalism, as I'm sure you know, was a form of journalism that broke all the rules. Okay, so it allowed the writer to be involved in the story. It made it broke traditional ideas of how narratives are told, etc. What Christopher Locke does is to say, what happens if you take those principles of Gonzo, those ideas of rule breaking, those ideas of changing the nature of business fundamentally? What happens if you do that in terms of marketing? The example he gives is one of Ford. Note, again, this is not exactly a small, groovy, left-wing company at all. Traditional manufacturing company. Ford, in February 2000, announced that they were giving 350,000 workers across the world free computers. Okay, just remember this was sort of 2000, so it was fairly unusual for people to have not only computers, but also internet connections. Okay, fast internet connections. Ford gave them these computers to its worldwide workforce because it said, quote, "We want to be able to improve communications, two-way communications, and make sure that our employees, every one of us, is connected to what's going on in the marketplace." What Ford did, and what Christopher Locke said is really good, is that they realized that their best way of connecting with their market, connecting with their customers, connecting with their stakeholders, etc., was to do it via the distributed network of the people within the company, these 350,000 people. The idea was that these people would be out there, they'd be listening on bulletin boards, they'd find out what people were saying about Ford products and cars, etc., etc. And it worked. More importantly, perhaps, what Christopher Locke does in Gonzo Marketing is say, okay, let's do a thought experiment. Let's push this further on, even than that. And this is when he gets into the idea of Gonzo Marketing. I'll just explain very briefly how he sort of put this idea together. He said, imagine that Ford found out that 10% of its workforce, 10% of Ford's workforce, were into organic gardening. Okay, they did an audit across the company and they found out what people were passionate about. And he said, imagine if they found out that 10% of these 350,000 people were all interested in organic gardening. So, okay, that's 35,000 people. Okay, what do we do with those 35,000 people, those 35,000 bits of passion within Ford? Locke says, what Ford could do would be to set up a gardening subsite for organic gardening. Okay, and Ford would allow, in fact, encourage, in fact, pay these 35,000 staff to form this website within the Ford web presence about organic gardening. Not about Ford, not about trucks, not about cars, etc., but about organic gardening. He says, what would that do? He says, one thing it would do would be really good for staff because they connect with each other, so they'd be better teamwork, etc. It would also make Ford open to other people who find them because they're interested in organic gardening. Okay, so far so viral. Locke says, let's take it from the next stage. He said, let's take some of the 35,000 Ford employees who are interested in organic gardening and we'll make them emissaries. We'll take them off their normal duty and your job within Ford is to form links with other organic gardening websites across the world. Okay? And you go to them and you say, we can help you. We can help make your site better. Okay, we're Ford, we've got loads of money. Okay, this was written before Ford's share price went through the floor, but we've got loads of money, so we will help you. We'll help you develop your organic gardening site. He said, imagine there is an existing gardening site called Organic Gardening World. He says, Ford, go to Organic Gardening World and say, we're Ford, we're going to give you computers, we're going to give you bandwidth, we're going to give you servers, we're going to give you technical advice, we're going to pay you to just run your organic gardening site. All we want you to do is to have on this site underwritten by Ford. Okay, you don't have to push Ford products, you don't have to do anything. What would happen if you did that? He said, well, obviously you get a bit of a broader reach, a bit of a brand reach, etc. says, but more importantly, he said, you'd be connecting with a cultural practice. You'd be connecting with people who are interested in organic gardening. So that you'd not only find what they were interested in, that might then feed back into the research and development arm of Ford in terms of let's develop our trucks so that they can do this to help people who are gardening, etc. He said it would also mean that people could come to Ford via a different route. They might, for instance, contact you via the organic gardening site and say, I see that you also work for Ford. You know, my front door fell off on my Ford Escort. Okay? And one of the Ford people connected to them via organic gardening can say, don't worry, I'll fix that for you. I'll get in touch with somebody and they can contact you. That sort of word of mouth connection, that sort of remixing of business and culture enables Ford to have a much broader reach. That's gonzo marketing. That's the idea of what are the traditional rules of marketing, the traditional rules of business, which is we own and control everything. We will only form relationships with people we know we can get something from. Rather than business saying, let's reach out, let's take what we've got and enable people to do things with it. So how does this relate to us? How does this relate to us as designers or advertisers, etc.? How can we take these principles of wikis or traditional, or of gonzo marketing into our own work? You notice that when we sent you the brief for this assessment, we said that you were a strategic communications and design consultancy. We deliberately chose that phrase because we wanted you to think beyond design and beyond advertising. The projects that you're now developing, and they're coming on great, they're moving forward in exactly the direction we hoped they would. And if you think about it, what you're doing now is going far beyond just offering advice about advertising or marketing or design. You are now rethinking the business models of some of your clients. You're now thinking that IKEA's job is not just to flog cots, it's to form a relationship with pregnant couples. You're reworking Procter & Gamble's, even its charity work, by saying our job is not just to help them flog something or get donations in, but is to work with teachers, to form a new relationship with schools. So you're a strategic communications consultancy. Your e-publications that you're developing are part of that strategy. Whether you're the designers or you're the strategists, marketing and advertising people, your e-publication is part of rethinking the whole communications model that your client is working with. The criticisms that we've had before and that you're now responding to have been when you have said, my job is just to communicate the sales message of Costa, the sales message of Procter & Gamble, the sales message of Air France. No, your job is to look at how you can rework that communications to enable a new set of content relationships. So what we're encouraging you to do and what you're starting to do is to look at what happens when you open up their communication strategy, you open up their marketing and advertising strategy, and you open up their design strategy. So what happens when you say to the customers of IKEA, you can add the baby pictures to this book. We're not going to use our beautiful photographer or our wonderful picture. You can add the baby pictures. You can add the advice about which is the best restaurant to go to in Beijing. You can decide what is the most romantic place for this honeymoon. So you're encouraging the business to not just open up its communications, but open up its whole business model. You're encouraging them to open up their marketing. That marketing is not just your job or the company's job. Marketing, when it works well, as the Harry Potter example shows us, works best when you enable people with passion to tell the stories. You're opening up the research and development. What happens if IKEA learn that parents actually want a cot that does this? That flows back into the research and development. New products are created. You're opening up customer relationship management. I hate customer relationship management. I hate the word customer, I hate the word relationship, and I hate the word management. But that's the second question. You're opening up new ways of these customers contacting and complaining or coming up with ideas for your client. You're opening up the whole realm of communications. Communications is now becoming two-way, multi-way, rather than communication from the top. As designers or advertisers, you are used to doing communication one way from the top. Your e-publications are opening up that potential to communication. So your challenge is how do I design for that openness? How do I design for wiki relationships? How do I design for gonzo? How do I design for crowdsourcing? How do I make my design encourage, enable, and empower people to take those ideas forward? How do I design for collaboration? How do I design for co-authorship? How do I design for flexibility? How do I design an e-publication or a communication strategy that is flexible enough to move with the passions of the customers? So if the customers start to change, we change with them. We don't try and hold them back. We ride on the back of that passion. The challenge that we've set you in terms of this assessment is huge, because we're not just asking you, the design students, to make a pretty thing, nor are we just asking the advertising students to come up with a coherent business strategy. No, we're asking you to rethink and revolutionize the whole concept of the business of your client. That's the challenge you've got. And now I shall pass on to the second half.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Right, so this is my half of the lecture, and I am going to play devil's advocate here, and I'm going to focus specifically on this idea of wiki business and using Wikinomics and as a way of doing business. So far we've been talking about prosumers, presumption, active consumers, because you have Web 2.0, it lets you do all these things, the idea that, you know, your consumers are also producers. Right? You're familiar with this idea by now? Good. So, some business guys thought, hey, that's a really good idea. Let's use that as a way of running businesses. If your consumers are also producers, why not get them to produce our business offering? So, just to recap quickly, that Tapscott and Williams's book, Wikinomics, the principles that they outline in the first chapter and throughout the book is that Wikinomics is about peering, sharing, and being global and being open. Okay? So, peering, no hierarchies, is flat, there's no sort of everyone is equal, everyone participates in this and with equal access. There is no hierarchy, there's no expert, there's no authority in this kind of model. Sharing, so there is no distinction between private and public, okay? So, you know, there's no idea of private property, there's no part of the business offering that is out of bounds. Wikinomics, they say, is great because it's global. You can reach lots of talent pool that would otherwise be restricted by geography. I swapped that around. And it's open. So it's, well, global and open. So your talent pool goes all over the world and anyone and everyone can access. Okay? Why? It's good to check out this guy, Michael Bowens, who incidentally, he lives in Chiang Mai, and he writes a lot about this collaborative economy and Wikinomics. And he recently published this document with Orange Labs. Orange is in the telecommunications company. And he talks about this collaborative economy, and he gives these business justifications for the wiki model, the crowdsourcing model. He says, well, we need to rethink the way we do business because community dynamics is now essential ingredient of business. And you can kind of see that now with all these agencies popping out new roles, you know, we want a digital community manager. You see sometimes that as a job description. So community, this idea of community is now more and more an essential part of business. The other thing which we have, hopefully you know, it's obvious to you that now we've been banging on about how the privatization of IP, intellectual property, according to these guys who champion Wikinomics, is no longer productive and untenable, okay? So hanging on and clinging on to your intellectual property and clinging on to your copyright, they argue, is not the best way to do business anymore. And There are some sort of, they give other kinds of justifications for it, and you can go and look all these different models up. One of the ways that Michael Bowens and his collaborators, they talk about attention economy, they talk about information economy, they talk about, they talk about the experience economy. And the idea is that we're no longer moving, we're moving away from the sort of traditional format of doing business, because it's no longer the company that sells the product. It's now about gaining the attention. Attention is scarce in an information economy. You know, there's lots of information out there. There's lots on the web. You now need to fight for attention. So there are all these sort of business economic justifications for how we need to move towards Wikinomics. Paul, my presentation has gone funny.
It's being crowdsourced.
Can we swap?
Yeah.
You sabotaged my lecture.
Sabotage. Paranoid. I'll have to leave that running because it's still got the...
Sorry, guys. I don't know. My presentation just went funny in... Yeah, okay, it just went funny because, okay, sorry. Okay, take two. Okay, so Wikinomics principles, traditional business, Wikinomics principles, okay, so going back to that slide that I stopped at, okay, so their business justification is that the crowd is king, all right? And so go and look at all these different ideas that they put forward for justifying this Wikinomics model, this crowdsourcing model. You know, we're fighting for attention, we're all about pulling, we're no longer about pushing products at your consumers. You know, now we keep talking about Web 2.0, the consumer and the consumers, the producers, the prosumers are king, okay? The crowd is king. So this idea of Wikinomics as a better way of doing business is often applied for product development. So if you go to Ben & Jerry's, for example, they invite you to suggest a flavor and give you their ideas for the ice cream flavor that you like. Have you ever had Ben & Jerry's ice creams? Yeah, they're good, aren't they? My favorite is Chunky Monkey. So, often in product development, and here's another example. There are these various websites floating around the internet. You can go and have a look, and they all operate on this idea of crowdsourcing, okay? So using the crowd to get ideas for product development, to do business ideas, and to innovate, all right? That's what they always sort of sell to you, innovation, okay? So these are some of the crowdsourced examples. And I mentioned MoFilm in the last lecture. MoFilm, they kind of crowdsource filmmakers to make films for brands, okay? And usually these brands will pay these filmmakers a certain amount of money as a prize if they choose their film. Innocentive, which Paul talked about, which P&G uses. Innocentive also sort of crowdsource ideas for innovation. And P&G uses, one of their earliest clients was P&G. So the idea, the basic idea of this crowdsourcing wiki idea, you know, is supposedly the future of corporate R&D. So there are some examples here. Nine Sigma is another example I found where they kind of use the commitment to open innovation. There's also an example in advertising. I gave you guys an example in the last lecture. I found another one called Ludwig and Partners, and they have a very interesting sort of explanation. They say that we're not an ad agency. We create new ad agencies every day for each client's unique needs and opportunities, matching their issues to the people best suited to solve them. When a job's done, the team is dissolved, ready for new assignments. So this is their sort of crowdsourcing model for advertising. So every time there's a new client, they crowdsource for a new art director, new copywriter, and they put together to try and answer this creative brief. So it all sounds very romantic, great, fantastic. Why isn't everyone doing this? And I was reading about all these companies and I was reading about all these wonderful Wikinomics business models. I was asking myself, what is a crowd? Okay, what do you mean by crowd? Who is this crowd? Where do they come from? Where do they live? What do they do? So I found, you know, this, I think a nice way of sort of thinking about the crowd is from a business practice point of view, is to see how it moves from individual to crowd. So in an individual, some of you want to become art directors, I believe, or copywriters or whatever. So the individual art director, individual source of creative design. Then a lot of agencies, they have teams. So you have the art director, the copywriter, and the account executive. So they're a team developing creative design and art direction. Then you have the ad agency itself. Okay, so we're moving from the micro now to the macro. Ad agency, organization, it's modern, it's functional, it's coordinated properly, and there are hierarchies. Okay? In a well-defined space as well. So they're usually geographically bounded. So the idea of this crowd, according to the Wikinomics principle, is that it's spread out, it's self-organizing, like those birds that Paul showed you. No established leadership roles, flat structure, and not even a fixed office space. No fixed space, okay? What can the crowd do? And by now you should be familiar with some of these authors. They call it all kinds of different things. Crowd means, collective intelligence that Henry Jenkins is. Clay Shirky calls it, and Paul mentioned this before, cognitive surplus, okay? Surplus of brain power. If you hit a lot of people come together, put their brains together, even if a very small percentage of them are actually talented, that's still a lot, okay? So they all call it different names. One of the earlier ones called it crowdsourcing is from Jeff Howe. He published in the Wired magazine and came up with this phrase called crowdsourcing. But it's worth asking, what exactly do you mean by crowdsourcing? Okay? Because it's not organized, somebody kind of has to organize it. There must be a process about it. How does crowdsourcing actually work in practice? Are you talking about something like Flickr, where you just have a place and everyone just sort of shares their ideas and shares their material? So if you go to Flickr, you search anything and you come up with all these random, they're not coherent in any way, they just sort of, you just come together in a common pool of ideas. Or are you talking about crowdsourcing, but you still have filtering and editing roles? So in this website, they invite you to submit your product ideas. And then when you submit your product ideas, there's this community, and then they pick the favorite product ideas, and then they build on them, and then they commit to buying them, and then develop maybe one or two in the end. So this is another kind of crowdsourcing, another kind of sort of Wikinomics at work. Or are you talking about many brains working towards one goal? So if you go to Mofin website and sort of play around with it, all these different brands have different briefs. So there's one brief, and then there's lots of people working towards this one brief, and there's different prize money for it. So very much like the gold digging company that in the first chapter of Wikinomics. So there are many different ways to do this crowdsourcing in reality, okay? And you can sort of see three different parties or three different sort of sections of it in this crowdsourcing process. Right, you have the crowd workers, okay? They're the ones who supply the ideas, talent, creativity. You guys are the crowd workers, okay? Then you have the crowdsourcers, the sort of middlemen, okay? So you have your Nine Sigma, your Threadless, your Innocentive, and then you have your clients and the buyers who buy the crowd's ideas. So there's P&G, and as Paul mentioned, IBM, Coca-Cola. Okay, so this is where my devil's advocate position comes in, and I'm saying, well, Wikinomics is not as great as it sounds, because there is this problem, and there's this phrase in the industry called digital sharecropping, okay, where the idea that, you know, you're sort of just harvesting free labor, harvesting information from your consumers. There's this cool website called Ditto, where you go in and you sort of, there's this technology that takes your mugshot, asks you to input what your budget is for buying spectacles, and what brands do you like, and they kind of have this fancy piece of technology where they put the glasses on you and they give you a special discount and they even rotate your image. And it's all very, very fancy and very, it's quite cool, you should try it out. The thing is that Ditto.com is a website that, you know, you can try on eyewear and it's great, it sounds really great, but actually you can argue that what do they do then with all this data they're collecting from all this consumers? What do they do with this data? Because now they know what kind of eyewear brand that we like, they know what's the most popular shape of glasses, what are people's budgets for personal preferences and budgets for buying glasses or sunglasses. What are they doing with all these data? Are they, you know, are they selling them on to the companies that sell glasses? So there is this ethics, this is unknowing crowd workers. You thought you were buying glasses, but actually you're providing free information to Ditto. The other problem, obviously, with crowdsourcing, again, is this idea that IP is, they'll give up the IP, companies will give up IP. No, not true. In practice, there's all kinds of legal tools that companies can use to make sure they still protect their IP. So if you go out and sign up for this Mofu thing, you're a filmmaker, you want to make a film, you want to win prize. Now, if you go to one of these briefs, so Coca-Cola has this amazing brief, make a film in Sydney, 2003, open happiness, so very open, but you got to download an NDA and sign it first, a non-disclosure agreement, okay? And it is in these types of tools that they protect their intellectual property. They still behave like traditional business, even though they are participating in this crowdsourcing Wikinomics type model. So, I find there are some myths about open innovation, okay? The myth that open innovation means being always open? No, not true. Open at some stages, but closed at others. They harvest ideas from the crowd, and then when they develop the product and they develop the idea, they deny the intellectual property from the people who supplied the ideas. Open innovation replaces internal R&D? No, not true. A lot of the ideas that come from the crowd are rarely market ready. Okay? Sharing copyright. All these companies, do they really share copyright? Like I said, not true. NDA, legal protection, actually, if you look at it, who do they favor? They favor the clients and the buyers. They do not favor the crowd workers. Okay? So, at the very heart of this problem is Wikinomics and the concept, this idea of capitalist economy that we all live in, is just not a happy marriage, okay? You have companies who are, you know, profit maximization. They want to make money. As long as they want to make money and they want to make lots of it, Wikinomics will always only be realized conditionally, okay? They're always conditions. Terms and conditions. Always read your terms and conditions. Okay? So the critique is, let's look at the Wikinomics principles again. Peering. Is it really peering? No. There are always implicit hierarchies. when you participate in all these crowdsourcing things, there's always, whether the agency or incentive, they still behave like the experts. They still behave as the authority in this crowdsourcing business. Quality, now this is another thing that clients are worried about, because actually clients, having a lot of ideas does not mean that all the ideas are quality. And companies or clients will always try, businesses will try to find a way of distinguishing quality from just a product that is popular. Okay? And this idea that sharing and open, well, the commons, which is this idea of Wikinomics, Wikicommons, is not a commodity. Okay? So the fact of the matter is a lot of businesses still operate on this traditional model and they still sell stuff and they still make commodities. Now, the commodity is very different from the commons. So how does that work? How do you maintain that? How do you really build a sustainable business model if you are selling commodities and you want to do this wiki commons thing? Okay? The idea that Wikinomics is global, not necessarily true. It's worth investigating, you know, looking at all these crowdsourcing. Who are the people that actually contribute to these crowdsourcing models? And if you have you heard of the Amazon Mechanical Turk? If you go to Amazon organizes this website called the Mechanical Turk, where it's basically for software engineers. There are some tasks that a computer cannot do, very, very small tasks. For example, describing what's inside an image. Okay, a computer cannot do that. Only a human can look at an image and tell you what's inside and describe it. So there are these minute tasks that lots of computers, software engineers and technicians and scientists are trying to, they don't have time to do it. So Amazon set up this business called Mechanical Turk, where they post up all these little mini tasks, okay? And they pay you a certain amount of money for each task you complete. So it's a crowdsource model, again, of doing business. Now, there's a research that did about this Amazon's Mechanical Turk that shows that actually most of these crowd people, these crowds that engage with this Mechanical Turk are from India, okay? A very large percentage of them are from India, they're highly educated, they're out of work, and they're paid by this Mechanical Turk at a lower than the average wage. But because they have no other options, they continue to do it and they treat it as full-time employment, not something they do for fun and for love. Okay? So this idea of global is worth really examining. Who are the crowd workers? Where are they? And are they being exploited? To truly follow the Wikinomics principles in business practice, we have to throw away the money incentive or goal of profit maximization. Become a charity. And recently, Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, was in the news and he was under a lot of pressure for monetizing Wikipedia. And he said that, you know, Wikipedia is a charity. Okay, it's not a for-profit business. But you got to ask yourself, is it realistic to expect businesses all to become charities? Okay? And you can see that actually some businesses, they don't want crowdsourced ideas. Now, you know, BP very famously rejected 908 ideas for saving the Gulf in 2010. And this illustrates the gap between the material production and immaterial production. What do I mean by this? So the material production, traditional companies like BP, they harvest oil, they have all these factories and workers, they make parts and things like that. And then there's the immaterial production. All these people who work for Innocentive, they produce ideas, immaterial things, innovation, ideas, creativity, design ideas, whatever. Thousands of scientists came together to respond to Innocentive's strive to get ideas to solve to save the Gulf. BP said, no, I don't want it. I don't want your 908 ideas, okay? Because the traditional businesses and a lot of businesses out there are tradition. They are moved by money, 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 money. And crowdsourcing and Wikinomics isn't moved by money. So what are they moved by? So Michael Bowens and Arvidsson argue that actually to run the Wikinomics principles, we need to change the way we think about economy, and we're actually thinking about an ethical economy. Running businesses for profit, okay, but not for profit maximization. Okay, so like a charity, basically. Charities have to make money, but their end goal is not to make a lot of it. Their end goal is to do something else that is charitable. So this is what Bowens and Arvidsson is arguing. You know, you want to make money, okay, fine, you make money, but you don't aim to maximize it, which is the capitalist model. Okay, serve other things of value other than capital. And what are these other things of values if not money? What is valuable to you if not money?
Social status.
Social status, what else? Nothing is valuable to you except money. Faith. The ethical economy, according to Bowens and Arvidsson, is about friendships, knowledge, commons, creativity, innovation, relationships, equality, fairness, truth, justice. So nice, right? The commons, the ethical economy. And one such model they give is this one. Does it play? Oh, no. Have you heard of couch surfing? Couch surfing is this thing that trades, is a network that isn't moved by money, they are moved by a different value, by friendships, by love, by making friends. So I'll show you a bit of this.
You know, when you go into a hotel and you have no clue who is who, house surfing is a bit different. If you come to my place, you get to know me, you get to know my friends and family, you get to know the activities I do. So house surfing is a real beautiful experience.
Okay. First of all, it's a hospitality network.
It's a lot of fun. It opens doorways between people and events and activities that you might otherwise miss.
I don't like to refer to couch surfing as a site, as the website. I prefer to refer to it as a community.
Couch surfing for me is just a really great, genuine way to meet people.
Hey. Wherever I go, I want a friend there, even if I didn't meet them yet.
Couch surfing is really about meeting people from other cultures and getting to know other cultures and just making connections.
Let's say I want to know more about Europe, about Austria, whatever it is I want to know more about. And if I can't go there, then couch surfing brings it to me.
Hi.
There's so many lovely people who are drawn to couch surfing, and it's really altruistic. It brings out the best in people.
Couch surfing for me is a door, a gateway to a fantastic alternative way of traveling, which is much more authentic.
It brings people together and it reminds them that we're all one.
It's just a great experience. We feel like we've brought a piece of the world into our living rooms.
It's the ideal. Perfect thing. There's no money involved.
People in couch surfing are so good. I like them.
So this is how couch surfing works. People give up their couches for free. You travel, you sleep on their couch, you move on, you make friends with them, they take you out. So this is the kind of ethical economy that Bowens and Arvidsson was talking about, where it is driven, moved not by money, okay? You know all the things they're talking about. We want to make friends, we want to learn about new cultures. You want to, you get to know people's families, get the local knowledge. All of these things of value that couch surfing thrives on or is moved by is not monetary. So there's no money that changes hands in this network. However, they have been facing difficulties recently. I think in 2010 they became a public company, and then in 2011 they changed their terms and conditions so that all the information you put on Couchsurfing site, you surrender to Couchsurfing to do whatever they want with it. What do you think they will do with it? So this idea of Wikinomics and this idea of ethical economy is Great. It sounds fantastic. We should all become charities. Is that realistic, though? Is it realistic? So it's worth asking yourself, is it realistic to eliminate profit maximization motive? And how do you even maintain such a model? Couchsurfing started off and it was a booming success, and then in the last 2 years, it's been facing difficulties. Are crowd workers, the second question you should ask, are crowd workers fairly treated, or are they fair labor? Or as I said to you earlier, don't be a digital sharecropper, okay? Are you working very hard, giving up your creative ideas so that you make somebody else very rich? And then there's this question of quality versus quantity as well, which is a lot of companies are struggling with. So this is my sort of side of the critique of Wikinomics, and this is still very much a debate, and I hope all of you sort of engage with this debate, especially for your EPUBs, because Georgia came to see me this morning and she asked me, does my EPUB have to make money? That's a very reasonable question, because that's a question that a client would ask, okay? A client would ask, what's the return on investment on this? How many pounds is your EPUB going to make me for every pound that I spend on it? Clients do ask that. I'm not saying that your EPUB has to make money, but this is a tension that you have to consider and think about.